Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's the news roundup. It's been a big week for news alerts. On the West Coast, drought, fires, and heat. On the East, legal rulings from not one, but two Supreme Courts. And everywhere else, there's the COVID-19 Delta variant blazing through America's unvaccinated population. We'll unpack that and a bit more on the roundup today. We'll kick things off with Lisa Desjardins. She's a correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, it's always great to have you on.
Great to be here.
So let's start with this latest news out of the Supreme Court. This week, the justices wrapped up their term with a bang, upholding two pieces of controversial voting rights policy in Arizona. Which pieces of Arizona legislation were before the court, Lisa?
There were two. They were both notable. One was an Arizona law that makes it a felony to deliver someone else's absentee ballot. A lot of folks might be familiar with this practice. Democrats have used it a lot to reach communities that they feel are underserved, to go out and collect those absentee ballots, get them, turn them in. Arizona outlawed that. And that was a question that Democrats said was discriminatory, because especially minorities, we know minority community, marginalized communities, have a harder time getting their absentee ballots in. And in particular in Arizona, where a very large amount of Native American population lives without access to a mailbox. So Democrats said this was discriminatory to ban this practice. The other provision there was about provisional ballots for voters who cast their ballot in the wrong precinct. Arizona's law threw out those ballots. And again, Democrats said that was discriminatory. We do know from research that this is another situation where voters of color generally are affected more than anyone else. They are the ones who vote in the incorrect precinct more often than any other.
And that first law you mentioned, since it's upheld, it'll only allow voters, their family members, or their caregivers to collect or deliver a completed ballot. How did the verdict shake out? Which justices ruled which way?
This, you know, we've had such an interesting few weeks where there were some unpredictable splits in the court. This was the ideological split that I think many of us had been expecting. 6-3 with the conservatives voting to uphold Arizona's law and the liberals railing against it. I have to say, reading the responses, the opinion, and also the dissent in this case, I have rarely seen opinions that have attacked one another so openly. This was a case where the justices felt very strongly. Elena Kagan wrote that this really was a very dangerous potential dismantling of the Voting Rights Act, but Justice Alito wrote that he felt that the Arizona laws were not enacted with a racially discriminatory purpose. But one of the questions here, is the purpose enough, or is it the outcome that matters? And that's what Kagan was arguing.
What does this mean for similar laws restricting voting rights across the country, Lisa? Because we've seen these laws pop up in several states.
Universally, Democrats and Republicans believe that this means that Republicans who want to enact more voting restrictions will have a stronger footing with the Supreme Court, that this raises the bar. Now, it doesn't eliminate any potential kind of suits over discriminatory practices here, but it raises the bar to be much higher than it was before. That it's not just enough to show that there is some discrimination happening, but you have to also show the intent, and you have to essentially prove more than you had before. That it has to be a law almost enacted specifically to discriminate, and that is what Democrats say is dangerous here. And I think that Democrats now have some soul searching to do about how they react. This is a kind of case that could affect even the discussion in the Senate over the filibuster. And if they need to pass voting rights legislation, to do it, they have to break the filibuster. And this case pushes kind of those tensions very high.
And what does this mean for the Voting Rights Act as a whole?
Well, you know, the Voting Rights Act stands, but there, I think, we will see a very large discussion over how to change it. And there is, of course, the Democrats in the House have passed H.R. 1, that the For the People Act, that is a very large act, but it does not stand any chance in the Senate right now. So they're trying to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is smaller, but still would essentially tell states that they need to be, they need to get pre-clearance in order to pass any kind of law that is seen as discriminatory. It would give the federal government more power to rail in states in this area. But right now, the Supreme Court is giving the power to the states.
And what other cases did the court make decisions about this week that really stood out to you?
Well, I think the other one that we got was that was so significant was a case from Americans for Prosperity versus essentially California. This was about dark money. Americans for Prosperity, a lot of folks know, is a Koch brothers related organization, conservative organization. The question here was whether California could force them to reveal their largest donors' names to the state. And you know, this is sort of one of the final cases about after Citizens United, where Citizens United declared that donors had certain rights in terms of funding, but disclosure was allowed. This ruling, again, 6-3, the conservatives' ruling in favor of Americans for Prosperity, declared that, in fact, California could not force that disclosure by donors. That is a very huge defeat for Democrats, specifically a win for conservatives and Mitch McConnell, who want to see anonymous donations in large amounts to groups like Americans for Prosperity that are technically nonprofits. And I want to say one thing that's interesting to me is that the court in that case, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion, stressed that the reason they felt that this should stand, that the donor should not have to be disclosed, is that it was a chilling effect on freedom of association. It's so interesting to me that in that case, the conservative court kind of opened up their assessment of chilling effect to benefit the Americans for Prosperity, versus in the voting rights law, they went the other direction, right? They decided that, no, they weren't worried about a chilling effect on voters. They were more worried about the rights of the state legislature and what it should do.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Eugene Daniels is a White House correspondent with Politico. He's also co-author of the Political Playbook. Eugene, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, some legal news out of Philadelphia this week. Actor and comedian Bill Cosby is free after serving 3 years in prison. That's of a 3 to 10 year prison sentence. And this was for sexually assaulting Andrea Constand. 60 women have publicly accused Cosby of drugging and assaulting them. Eugene, what happened here? Why is Cosby out?
Yeah, it's one of those, it was something that was quite shocking for a lot of people. I think people, you know, there's so much news happening nowadays that people have stopped paying attention to what was going on with Bill Cosby. But essentially there was an agreement that was made in a 2004 case with Bill Cosby that said that what he said in that conversation was not going to be used against him, and it ended up being used against him in this case against Constand. And so that is why he got out. And you saw shock among, you know, anyone watching this, the Me Too movement, and, you know, also in the Black community. There was a huge, the Cosby case was a huge conversation starter in the Black community, as you know, where, you know, he was such a huge icon. In the show, the Cosby Show was such a huge example of what Black people could be. And so this has complicated that even further with him being out now.
Lisa, what happens next at this point?
Well, Bill Cosby now is immune from criminal prosecution in this case. He will face civil lawsuit for the same accuser in Los Angeles County. That continues, and that testimony can be used in that case. But otherwise, he is a free man. I think that part of the conversation that's also still reverberating, and we've seen this has been one of the stories that has gotten the most attention, is how Felicia Rashad reacted to this. Of course, his co-star on The Cosby Show. She is a dean at Howard University, and her initial reaction on Twitter was to say that justice has been served. You know, this was sort of rolling back of an injustice. Of course, you know, on college campuses, there's a very important conversation about sexual assault. She later added a clarification saying, I support survivors of sexual assault. But the university itself responded and said that her statement was really not, it lacked sensitivity. And there's a lot of discussion about her reaction.
And Eugene, what do you make of Felicia Rashad's response here and Howard University's response? Was it sufficient?
I think that for Felicia Rashad, it was just really shocking, I think, for a lot of people. Twitter is not real life, which we keep having to remind ourselves, but it did take up a lot of space that day because she had kind of been very silent and quiet throughout this process, hadn't really talked about the situation that much, though we knew that she had a strong relationship with Bill Cosby. She had been pretty quiet throughout the process. And so seeing this what people wanted to see, some people wanted to see, was Howard University pull her from the deanship. I don't think that is what's going to happen. And so I think what you have now is Howard University trying to gauge just how bad the fallout is from this and how long that sustained. Because if it continues and, you know, people continue to call for her to be pulled, they may have to make some other kind of disciplinary action. But at this point, I think they're just kind of in wait-and-see mode.
Coming up, temperatures skyrocket in the Pacific Northwest, and the Delta variant comes to America. We'll be back with more in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Now let's get back to the news roundup. Before we move on, a quick update on the collapsed condo in Surfside, Florida. Yesterday, rescue efforts paused after workers noticed cracks forming in the still-standing portion of the condo building. They resumed later in the afternoon, but it's led to renewed concerns about the safety of the site itself. The county's mayor says they plan to carefully demolish the rest of the building while the rescue operation continues. President Biden visited the site yesterday and promised to have the federal government pay for the cost of the disaster response. Let's move to the West Coast. This week, President Biden met with governors and other stakeholders to discuss recent scorching temperatures. The shattering heat wave is likely to blame for hundreds of deaths across British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington State. And Lisa, for people who are not up to speed, when we talk about scorching temperatures, how hot are we talking about?
Unbelievably hot. Portland, Oregon, set its last hot heat record more than 50 years ago, but they broke that record 3 days in a row this week, with the final high record being 116 degrees on Monday in Portland. I know your listeners out there in Portland are nodding. They felt it. And these are places that don't have air conditioning necessarily to the same degree as spots in the South. In Canada, there were places in Canada that were hotter than places in the Middle East. So this is something the president called a wake-up call on climate. But I have to say, in Washington, it is not clear what our lawmakers are doing to really take this on. President Biden has some proposals, but right now they're not really part of any bill that is clearly moving. There's a lot of hope. It's possible they end up in the Democrats' potential large package. But for climate activists, there is real concern right now about what exactly is going to happen. What will Washington do? It's not clear.
Well, President Biden has joined scientists in blaming climate change for the record-breaking heat.
Climate change is driving the dangerous confluence of extreme heat and prolonged drought. We're seeing wildfires of greater intensity that move with more speed, and last well beyond traditional months of the fire season. And that's a problem for all of us.
Eugene, we keep seeing these extreme climate events. Are we seeing any real shift in climate policy coming out of the White House?
Not from the White House, right? This is a White House that started and has kind of pinpointed climate change as one of the top four things that they are dealing with when it comes to, you know, what's happening in this country and on this planet. And so they haven't pushed as far as climate activists want them to, right? Like was just said, there isn't a place for any stronger climate legislation that's going to pass, that's going to get 60 votes. And if they want to pass it through the reconciliation process, which we've all learned so much about over the last 7 or 8 months, they're going to have to add it into the reconciliation bill that they have that deals with infrastructure. And that's where the conversation is right now. You have a lot of concern from climate activists that this White House, who, when they do want to make a big point, the president will do a speech. He will, you know, he has been in the, he was in the Senate for 36 years. He was 8 years as vice president. He knows how to, you know, do the carrot and stick when it comes to making sure legislation gets written and passed. And they don't feel like they've seen that. And they feel like we're running out of time to get some of these things done. I think the more evidence that piles on, right? You look at even what happened in Surfside, you know, talking about erosion, you know, people talking about erosion in places like Florida, talking about the extreme weather in Washington, D.C., when there was a tornado warning just yesterday. So all of this evidence is mounting more, and the climate activists are hoping that they can continue to push this White House and Congress to actually get some things done.
But Lisa, it's striking to me that the science is clear. Again, we keep seeing these extreme climate events. There's a cry from the public saying, hey, we need movement here. But the policy, the change in practices are lagging behind, not just here in the U.S., but for much of the globe. What will it take to shift this dynamic?
It's the right question. And, you know, we know that there's a generational divide here. We know that younger generations really feel this urgent need, maybe even up through Gen X, you know, but there is kind of this generational tension with baby boomers who are the ones in power right now, not acting enough and maybe not feeling the consequences here. There's also the partisan divide. Republicans think leave it up to the corporations, that if there is a good motive here, if there's a good new business model here, then corporations will step up. And we've seen some corporations not only step up, but say, hey, Congress, you have to do more. There's some bright spots. Germany is trying to accelerate its plans to go to a net neutral carbon model. But you're right. It is the kind of situation that just shows the problem with our system. It is geared towards stability. It is very bad at dealing with long-term problems.
Well, let's turn to another crisis and bring in one more voice. Lauren Weber is the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, infection rates are surging among America's unvaccinated, thanks in part to the Delta variant. Missouri recently reported 3,000 new cases, a rise of nearly 20% over the last week. Here's Dr. Steve Stites of the University of Kansas Health System.
We're not usually this full in June, but we're really full. Mm. And everybody's really full. So if we have a surge, trouble will come a lot sooner this time than it did the last time.
Now, Missouri isn't the only state grappling with more infections among the unvaccinated. Lauren, explain what's going on.
So Missouri currently ranks, it's in the bottom 15 of states for fully vaccinated population. We've got about 39% of folks vaccinated here in the state of Missouri. But the problem is that where you're seeing this explosion, the Delta variant, it's in counties, typically more rural, that have sometimes under 25% vaccination rates. And as we know, the Delta variant is more contagious. And so you're seeing, you know, a higher explosion of cases as, you know, we begin to open up, or we have been opening up. And you're also seeing a reticence to put in masking orders or any sort of, you know, control measures at a state level. You know, Governor Parson never did institute a masking order in the state of Missouri and has been, you know, talking about the need for personal responsibility for getting the vaccine, but also cautioning that, you know, it is a personal choice. And you see this confluence of factors coming down into, you know, places like Springfield, Missouri, which has seen an explosion of cases and is already starting to transfer, since it's a smaller city, some of their patients to Kansas City and St. Louis because the hospital needs that extra capacity.
Now, as you said, some states are not only aren't requiring masks for the unvaccinated, they've banned mask mandates completely. What's the political calculus around COVID-19 right now? And could it change if we see another surge?
I mean, time will tell if it will change. But I mean, in Missouri itself, you know, just this week, you had legislators, you know, discussing a potential ban on hospitals requiring vaccinations for all of its employees. I mean, this is a state that certainly has had, you know, heavy backlash to some of the COVID restrictions put into place. I mean, you've seen state, you know, health departments, some of them, you know, one health department in Kansas City never actually got as much COVID-19 relief funding as a local cruise ship company. I mean, this is, you know, at the local level, there is varying degrees of frustration and retribution against health departments and the COVID-19 response. And I think, you know, the Delta variant, you know, it does not care what your political beliefs are or what the political calculus is. It's continuing to infect at higher rates. And you're seeing that play out in a state like Missouri, where vaccination rates are also continuing to fall. I mean, in the beginning of April, about 55,000 people were getting vaccinated per day. And now we're down to 6,000. And, you know, you're not seeing this heavy interest in vaccination, even with such lower vaccination rates.
And what is the Delta variant? What's important to know about it?
What's important to know about it is it's a tweak on the original COVID-19 virus. It as far as researchers can tell, it is more contagious than the original version that has been circulating. And so if you are in a room with someone with the Delta variant, the current scientific research would seem to indicate you are more likely to contract COVID-19 because it is just more easily spreadable if you are unvaccinated. That said, if you are vaccinated, the vaccines have proven to show still a very high efficacy, somewhere in the upper 80s, low 90s, against the Delta variant. So, I mean, it just goes to show the vaccination is such an incredible tool against the spread of this disease. And, you know, there's been a lot of leaders in Missouri and in other states that are trying to press populations to get vaccinated to prevent kind of the strain on hospitals that we're starting to see in the state.
Missouri's governor is encouraging the full reopening of schools, but a recent investigation found more than 100 Missouri schools are relying on unproven air cleaning technology. Explain more about that story.
Yeah, so across the country, in Missouri, we found 100 schools that are doing this. But across the country, there's over 2,000 schools that are investing in air cleaning technology. You know, you've got a lot of schools with a lot of parents and staff that want to keep their kids and folks safe against COVID-19. And a lot of air cleaning companies have marketed their technology as having, you know, 99.9% inactivation rates of the virus. But what the experts have told us is that oftentimes these claims are, quote unquote, often unproven, according to a commission from the Lancet. And the concern being is that these schools are investing millions of federal relief COVID funds, which can be used to improve school ventilation, into technology that is often unproven and potentially resting their laurels on the sense that this is, you know, giving them some sense of security when it may or may not be working for them.
Now, LA County has jumped on board with the World Health Organization, is now recommending everyone, including the fully vaccinated, wear masks indoors. Lauren, what's the state of the pandemic in California right now? Why make this move?
You know, California, especially in LA County, has seen its numbers inch up, and they're concerned also about, you know, an explosion with potentially the Delta variant. And it's not just LA County. Actually, in Missouri, St. Louis County just, you know, issued a similar recommendation that people start to wear masks inside. Now, you have not seen that in Chicago or New York, and the CDC has made it clear that it will be up to local jurisdictions to recommend masking indoors, depending on local case burden. But I think California is aggressive when it comes to COVID-19 and prevention of it. So they're seeing this as a precautionary step as they see their numbers begin to rise.
Now, Eugene, the CDC has given no indication it plans to change its own mask guidance right now. What conversations are happening on Capitol Hill around growing concern over the Delta variant?
Yeah, I mean, they are very, very worried. And I think the biggest worry in the White House and also on Capitol Hill is that there's going to be two Americas, right? There's going to be the America of people who have gotten vaccinated, and there's not going to be a lot of transmission back and forth because, as we've seen, and I think it was just reported today, even the Johnson & Johnson vaccine does well against this Delta variant and some of the other variants. And then you have this other America where people aren't getting vaccinated and they're not wearing masks, and then you're going back and forth. So the conversation right now is, how do you get people vaccinated? They're very worried about it. In this White House, they have done a lot. they've sent out, you know, the four principals, the president, the vice president, the first lady and second gentleman, out all over the country over and over, going to barbershops, going to different places to push out the idea that people need to get vaccinated to these people who, it's not at this point, it seems like it's not about access so much as it is about educating people and getting them to take the vaccine. And the one of the other things that they're really talking about is they know that getting people to put a mask back on after we've already kind of recommended, the CDC has already, you know, pulled that recommendation down of everyone wearing a mask. So now to go back and tell people that you have to put a mask on, or it's even recommended to put a mask on, even if you're vaccinated, they know it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle. And that's why they were so careful about pulling that recommendation down and, you know, kind of angering some folks who were confused on why we still were wearing masks at the time. And so all of that, it's making what they're working on so much more difficult.
You know, Lauren, we talked to a couple of experts about the vaccination progress, and they said there's really two groups we're having trouble reaching around vaccination: people who live in Republican-led states, and then younger people for whom access may still be an issue, getting time off of work, getting childcare. What do we know about that balance between access and just vaccine hesitancy right now? Where is the real holdup?
You know, I think, as you laid out in the question, there, you know, you have folks that are unable to take time off of work who, you know, don't want to miss work or have jobs that do not allow them to miss work. But you also have folks that just do not want to take the vaccine or have somewhat of a wait and see approach. And the deal is we've now been wait and seeing for quite a few months. So health departments, and you're seeing this variant explode, understandably, and the nation want people to get vaccinated to make sure that these cases do not continue to grow. And, you know, as you pointed out with the two Americas, the problem with that is that there is only, at the end of the day, one America. So if you continue to see explosions of these variants, the concern is that they would continue to mutate and that we would all be impacted. It's not just a vaccinated versus unvaccinated. You know, this is not just everyone is in it together at the end of the day, which is why it's so important to be able to get to these folks that are not necessarily wanting or have not taken the opportunity to get the vaccine.
Well, and Lisa, what does this all mean for the U.S.'s longer-term economic recovery if we're continuing to see this patchwork approach to COVID-19 policies, outbreaks linked to the Delta variant? Where does that leave us?
It's a significant problem, and it is, again, another speaks to the two Americas. We could see some states having to take more action to reclose places if they want, but of course, if they're conservative states, they're going to resist that. Now, it should be said that the United States is blessed to be far ahead of most of the rest of the world. We've seen other countries have to have renewed shutdowns in large areas. Australia, for example, is really struggling right now. Those economies are getting hit worse. So in some ways, the U.S. is doing better than almost anyone else economically dealing with the coronavirus. But there are major warning signs here. And in today's, the new unemployment report that just came out today, you know, unemployment ticked down, but there was an increase in the long-term unemployed. So these aren't just short-term problems now. And if the coronavirus sticks around, that is a very serious long-term economic problem.
Lauren Weber joined us. She's the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She gave us an update on the pandemic. Lauren, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Let's jump back into the conversation. Negotiations over police reform in Congress are not going well. Lawmakers missed the June deadline to strike a bipartisan deal, and on Wednesday, the Fraternal Order of Police said that negotiations were on the brink of collapse. Lisa, what's being negotiated? What are Democrats asking for, and what are Republicans asking for?
You know, through months and months of really difficult negotiations, we've seen three lawmakers, Tim Scott of South Carolina being the Republican involved, Cory Booker, Senator of New Jersey, Democrat, and Karen Bass, Democrat from California on the House side, work out a compromise that is not the ideal for any of them, but essentially would make police departments have more responsibility, be open to more lawsuits, civil lawsuits, for when force is misused by their officers. It likely means individual police officers would still be immune from those lawsuits. That's a compromise that Democrats put on the table. This was being drafted. And now, something that a lot of us know in Washington is the case, it is unelected folks in Washington that are the issue here. It is the National Sheriff's Association, which has problems with this compromise. I believe it is the idea of kind of more potential lawsuits for police departments and sheriff's departments that they are worried about. But the National Fraternal Order of Police is said to be on board. This speaks to the urban-rural divide here. And it's a real shame. My husband doesn't like when I use metaphors, so I'm going to do something dangerous here. Sometimes I miss. I'm going to stay away from sports. But it's a bit like what these lawmakers have done is like building a very tricky Jenga castle and, you know, a Jenga tower. And then they said to these police organizations, all right, what do you think? And the National Sheriff's Association doesn't like one piece, wants to pull that piece out. And if that happens, the whole thing collapses.
Eugene, what happens if they can't reach a deal?
Yeah, I mean, she lays out so perfectly there. It's one of those things where we're at this very precarious time. And as crime rates have risen around the country and for different reasons, one of the things that you keep hearing, and Karen Bass herself even said, was this concern about the public not wanting police reform or not wanting to hear about police reform while that's happening. And I think if nothing happens, then you end up with some very angry, very upset Democrats at the very least. You have a lot of Democrats who have been talking about this issue. Obviously, the quote unquote defund the police movement is one thing, and separate from what this bill would, if it does pass, would end up being. But it is the best chance they have at doing police reform after what happened after the murder of George Floyd, after all of the trial that we've seen. So there was this this real push on both sides of the aisle to get something done. So if it doesn't get done, if these police organizations, law enforcement organizations are able to kind of lobby and get some of these things pulled, then that's kind of it. I'm not sure exactly what plan B is, and it doesn't seem like anyone has a plan B at this point.
Well, President Biden gave an update on his $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan last Thursday.
We agreed on infrastructure. We made serious compromises on both ends. They'll give you the numbers. But they did not, and I understand their position, Republicans and this group did not want to go along with any of my family plan issues, the child care tax credits, the human infrastructure that I talk about.
Lisa, what are some of the serious compromises Biden is talking about here?
Well, essentially what the Democrats and Biden have agreed to do here, and what they're trying to do, is to pass two bills in tandem. One would be this narrow bill that's mainly surface infrastructure, transportation, and has some broadband in it, a few climate provisions. But it's a smaller bill in the neighborhood of $600 billion additional dollars spent versus many trillions. So they do this bill that Republicans, some Republicans, believe they can get on board. And then separately, Democrats would put all of the other Biden and Democratic priorities like child care, the families plan, things that he's mentioning there, ideas that could range from $2 to $6 trillion, depending on what Democrat you speak to. There's also some college and student funding in that idea. They know Republicans won't support that. So they're trying to do these on separate tracks, but it's a very awkward dance they're doing here because they're trying to pass one bill with Republicans at the same time as they pass a bill that's linked to it that Republicans greatly dislike. And the president made his job harder last week when he said that he would veto or he would not sign the smaller bill without the other bill. He walked that back. But I got to tell you, Jen, I have never seen so many angry text messages from my moderate Senate sources as I did over those 2 days. And it was Democrats and Republicans alike who felt that the Biden White House had sort of pulled a fast one on them. He did reverse that. But the trust levers at the White House or the Capitol are just so fragile right now that this was an issue where trust broke down. And all of this is going to be difficult to navigate, a little bit more difficult now because of the problems of this week.
Well, this measure would be passed through something called reconciliation in the Senate, which means it could take effect without Republican votes. Eugene, how does this work exactly?
So essentially, that reconciliation bill, they will have to, and it's also unclear how they're going to do this, keep Democrats together. So essentially, they only need to get to that 50 vote threshold of Democrats, and then add in the vice president there, and then there you have it. There's your bill. But there's so much that even Democrats don't agree on at this point. How much money it's going to cost is the biggest issue right now. Bernie Sanders, one of the far most progressive people in Congress, has thrown out $6 trillion with a T, everybody. Joe Manchin, who's on the other end of that spectrum, has said he's comfortable with $2 trillion. Biden gave $3 trillion. So we're seeing some numbers, and the sources that I'm talking to on the Hill say that is, while it sounds concerning, it is also actually exciting that they're seeing numbers. There's a lot of conversations on what goes in there. But as we talked about earlier on climate change, they are the more evidence that has been piling up over the last couple of weeks about issues with climate change and how it impacts America, the more and the rest of the world, the more that climate activists are fighting and worried to get things into that reconciliation bill, because there aren't a lot of chances to do that. There aren't a lot of chances to shore up kind of the quote unquote care infrastructure aspects of the country unless it goes through this reconciliation bill. So this really is, we have very soon, everyone's going to be talking about the midterms. And so this is kind of it. This is $600 billion bipartisan deal and whatever trillions of dollars they end up doing it through reconciliation. That's kind of going to be it for the kind of progress that's going to be able to happen on Capitol Hill for some of the bigger items on the Biden administration's agenda. Those things are huge. They will restructure America in a bunch of different ways. But it does mean that everyone is jockeying to put everything they want into this reconciliation bill.
Well, Lisa, I also wonder about the urgency question here. We saw major flooding in Detroit over the weekend. There was a bridge collapse recently, a pedestrian bridge collapse here in D.C. When we say the U.S. infrastructure is crumbling, that's not hyperbole. There are issues. So is there a point at which just the urgency of this issue can get Congress moving towards a solution more rapidly?
Well, I think that's how we got here to begin with, why we're even at this point where there is a very hard-won bipartisan potential deal here, is because everyone has problems in their states, in their districts. It is one thing that unifies Congress. Everybody needs money for infrastructure. However, this comes back to that same underlying theme here. Our Congress is terrible at long-term problems. They're great at short-term needs and short-term stability, but long-term problems get kicked down the road time and time again. And that's why what Eugene's saying is right. This is such a critical window on both these issues we've talked about, police reform and infrastructure. The time is not just this year, but really the next 2 months to figure out if this can happen. That has to do with sort of the appropriation schedule and also the fact that the first year of a new president is really the 1 year that we've seen in the past that can be productive. Biden knows this. Everyone in Congress knows this. The election next year is going to be ugly. Both chambers of Congress are on the ballot, and they need to get something done now if they're going to do anything. All of them feel urgency, but, you know, that hasn't led to them necessarily doing something in the past.
Well, Steve tweets, we can never find money for progress proactively, but we can always find it reactively when things are at a crisis level. Well, on Wednesday, the House voted to create a select committee to investigate the January 6th insurrection on the Capitol. Eugene, what will this committee be tasked with doing?
Yeah, and so a few things. One, they are going to try to figure out what happened that day. What happened, who was involved, who was to blame for January 6th. It's not so clear how much of the investigation is going to focus on President Trump. Obviously, there was an impeachment where the House feels like they did a lot of that work already. So it's not clear how much of that is going to look into him. But it is also going to look into what are the next steps? How can Congress protect itself to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And, you know, you have Democrats had 8 spots, Republicans 5, and one of those 8 spots for Democrats is actually being the person sitting in is Liz Cheney, the former Republican leader, who was pushed out because of her being so outspoken about President Trump's lying about the 2020 election, being so outspoken about January 6th and her feelings that Donald Trump had something to do with it. And you know, people were listening to him, and that is why that happened. So that is her feeling. And so her being on this committee is really, really interesting, and I think it's going to make for a different conversation than we're used to. She's coming at this from kind of a national security aspect, so she's going to weigh heavily into the idea of how do we keep this from happening? What kind of money does the Capitol Police need? What kind of money should, or kind of different changes in security do we need to have on a daily basis in Congress? And so that is what this committee is going to be tasked with. And who knows how long it's going to take. It's a little bit different than kind of what was kind of coined as like a 9/11 style commission. This is going to be a little bit different. They can take a lot of time, right, to do what they want. But I don't think they want it to go too far into next year.
Lisa, nearly all House Republicans voted against forming this committee. What does this mean for the challenges Democrats will likely face moving forward with this investigation?
I'm glad you raised that. Well, we have to hear yet from Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy on whether he will appoint members to this committee or not. As Eugene said, he can appoint 5 members that he can select. Speaker Pelosi has the right to veto some of those members if she chooses. But I believe it is in his interest to appoint Republicans to this, especially since Liz Cheney is already in there. Chairman Benny Thompson of the Select Committee has got to decide how long he wants this to go. He's indicated it will take longer than this year, which means we'll be talking about this in a very heated election year. He has indicated he's open to talking about President Trump's role, that he's not going to push for that, but he's open to it, which makes me think you've got also on the Select Committee, not one, but 2 Democratic impeachment managers who managed to impeach, and one of them who was part of the effort to impeach President Trump over January 6th. I'd be shocked if that is not part of this. And of course, Republicans will push back very, very mightily on that. But, you know, I have one other thing. I've got to tell people that the House, something is particular about the House side on this issue, different than the Senate. The tensions there over January 6th are deep, palpable, and emotional for both sides. It is something that is personal, and it is something that I think is still hovers over almost every action in the House right now.
A quick update on the New York mayoral race. New York City's Board of Elections has released new preliminary tallies of the top contenders for the Democratic mayoral nominee. Earlier this week, the board was forced to retract their results after accidentally including roughly 135,000 test ballots in the final count. The BOE is now predicting a closer race with Eric Adams, Catherine Garcia, and Maya Wiley all in contention. The BOE doesn't expect clear results until later this month. Also in New York this week, state prosecutors indicted the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, for tax fraud. Lisa, this case was first opened in 2018. Briefly, why did it take so long for charges to be brought?
Well, for one, they had to go through the courts to try and get access to Trump tax documents. That took years. They did succeed in doing that. And I will say this 25-page indictment was more serious than I expected it to be. It was not just about Weisselberg's benefits, you know, private school tuition, those kinds of things. This was about overt tax fraud, not paying payroll taxes, for example, for the Trump Inc. itself. There's quite a lot in this. You know, we'll have to see where this goes, but it is more significant than I had thought going into that indictment.
Eugene, briefly, how closely was former President Trump involved with this organization?
I mean, for years, you know, he obviously ran it. He ran the and did the day-to-day. For the 4 years of his presidency, you know, he backed off. He did not divest, as he kind of said he was going to, and his sons did it. And so that's the thing here, is that the question is not just, you know, what legal ramifications are there for former President Trump as the Trump org is being investigated and is being charged, and this goes through the court process. But also, how does that affect his brand, right? He became big and known because he was good at putting his name on things and branding things, and that's really huge for him. So this is going to be really fascinating to watch as we see how this shakes out and how it impacts Trump org, Trump hotels, what happens there, and will people spend their money there? What's going to happen? And some sources told Playbook that, in fact, this makes him want to run for office more, right? Him going to the border recently, having that Ohio rally, that huge Ohio rally, and also this case having his name out there. He wants to defend himself. And so it's actually pushing the idea that he wants to run in 2024 for president again even more, say some of his closest advisors.
That's Eugene Daniels. He's a White House correspondent with Politico. He's also co-author of the Politico Playbook. Also with us today, Lisa Desjardins, a correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, Eugene, thanks for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand, and Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
It's the News Roundup. For the next hour, we'll try to get to many of the biggest stories from overseas. China has been celebrating a big birthday. COVID continues to take its toll around the world. Today, we'll pay particular attention to the situation in Africa. And the U.S. has again been carrying out airstrikes on targets along the Syria-Iraq border. My guests this week are Sean Donnan, a senior writer for Bloomberg. Sean, happy Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Williams, the senior foreign editor of Vox. She's also the co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Jen, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
And David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Hi, David.
Hello.
Record-breaking temperatures have engulfed the Pacific Northwest this past week, potentially causing hundreds of heat-related deaths across Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia. Here's British Columbia's premier, John Horgan.
The big lesson coming out of the past number of days is that the climate crisis is not a fiction. It is absolutely real. The entire west coast of North America, from Baja to Alaska, is red hot and awaiting what could be another catastrophic fire season just ahead of us.
And after three straight days of recording the hottest temperatures Canada has ever seen, the town of Lytton, British Columbia, caught fire.
The whole town is on fire. I've ordered the town evacuated, and I told everyone as I was leaving town to leave. It took like a whole 15 minutes from, you know, the first sign of smoke to all of a sudden there being fire, you know, everywhere.
That was Lytton Mayor Jan Polderman speaking to the CBC on Wednesday. And we should say British Columbia reported at least 486 sudden and unexpected deaths over a five-day period. That's according to the Associated Press. David, just explain what we've seen over the last week, this move from extreme heat to wildfires.
Well, it's partly because they had a very dry season before this extreme heat event that, as you just played the tape there, it's really the whole of the West Coast. But it's worth stressing how the places that are on fire, like the village of Lytton in British Columbia, they normally are pretty cool around this time of the year. So the average daily highs for June in Lytton, the village that just caught fire, are 61 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's currently at 100, nearly 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a record for Canada. They've just beaten the Las Vegas hottest ever weather record. And this is being driven by a very strange atmospheric event called a heat dome, where you have this area of high pressure up in the atmosphere that drives hot air downwards, a bit like putting the lid on a saucepan. It increases the pressures, that even increases the heat, and it doesn't allow the hot air to escape. And the link with climate change is still a little unclear, but it was interesting that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the States, where you are, was saying that they think this could be linked by the fact that the Pacific Ocean, that vast body of water which contains so much heat energy, the difference in temperature between the east and the west of that vast ocean is very extreme. And that's that extreme heat gradient seems to be driving very unusual heat events. But I think clearly what we're seeing is that climate change, as you heard in that tape, is not just something to argue about for politicians or to wonder about for our grandkids. It's here right now, and particularly cruel when it hits places that are normally hot, not hot at all, like British Columbia, because they don't have air conditioning. They're not well set up for this. So it's an incredibly dramatic demonstration of what's at stake.
We had a meteorologist on to explain this extreme heat. Now, Sean, as the weather gets more extreme, we know there's both a human and environmental cost. But you write about economics. What impact are these events having on trade and economic policy?
Well, look, I mean, I think that's the point, is that climate change has really supercharged all of these weather disasters. And we are in the middle of another natural disaster of sorts in this pandemic, of which we've seen the economic consequences. And that is, you know, really the fear on the economic side is we're going to see more and more of this. That village of Lytton that we've been talking about, 90% of the structures have been destroyed there. There's going to be some real questions about whether or not that is a place that people will go back to. And as David said, this is not a desert community. This is a mountain community. This is a place that should be in some ways sheltered from all of the things that we associate with climate change, like rising sea levels and so on. And it just isn't. And so we just need to recalibrate how we think about the consequences of climate change for the economy. It's going to hit all of us in one way or another.
Jennifer, world leaders will be gathering later this year at a climate summit. What do you expect some of these more recent climate events? How do you expect them to shape the conversations we'll see?
Well, it's certainly going to add to the urgency, I think, for many people. But for many people who are going to be gathering, you know, this isn't new, right? This has been hitting communities around the world for a long time, especially, you know, communities that live in coastal regions, island communities, et cetera. And so, you know, the urgency for places, you know, like Canada, for the United States, places where, you know, we maybe have dragged our feet a bit when it comes to climate change and actually tackling it at the policy level, I think that will certainly kind of increase the urgency and the salience of it. But at the same time, you know, the politics hasn't really changed at home. We are seeing, you know, the conservative climate caucus being put together to kind of bring in Republicans to start being part of the conversation here in the U.S. about climate change policy. But at the same time, you still have those kind of structural, you know, political issues that are preventing the kind of really serious action that, you know, progressive groups, but also just experts are saying, we need to do this like yesterday. And it's still, you know, we're still seeing even now in the conversations about the climate package and infrastructure, et cetera, questions about whether, you know, the big actions will even be done here, let alone in many other countries. And we need to all do this together and like now to make this, you know, less horrible as it already is going to be bad, but try to minimize how bad it's going to be.
Bill on Twitter asks, will Western governments prohibit fireworks to avoid fires? And Jen, 4th of July here in the U.S. is this weekend. I mean, what are we hearing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is usually handled at the local level. You know, cities and you know, municipalities will have regulations about fireworks. You know, I'm from Texas. There are always kind of regulations that are within the city limits. You can't set them off. Everyone still does. It doesn't seem like there's a ton of enforcement. You know, everyone goes out with the garden hose and sprays down their roofs because they know that, you know, if a spark hits, it's been really hot. There's going to start a fire. But at the same time, people just love their fireworks. People really love to celebrate. It's kind of a big thing, and it's really hard to get people to stop doing it, even when there may be rules saying, hey, you know, there are fires everywhere. Please don't set off, you know, actual fires.
Yeah, rules and real risks. Well, another big story in Canada this week, the discovery of more unmarked graves at former boarding schools for Indigenous children. 182 more were found in British Columbia on Wednesday. Because of these discoveries, some groups called for the government to cancel July 1st festivities celebrating Canada Day this year, and protesters have pulled down statues of Queens Victoria and Elizabeth. David, how are Canadians responding to this most recent news?
It's just such a terrible tragedy. And of course, what's really interesting is that Canada actually confronted the fact that real horrors took place in these compulsory boarding schools that Canada ran in the 19th century and in the 20th century until the 1970s. Several years ago, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The government of Canada apologized formally to Indigenous people. So why is this now back in the news? It's because you're seeing new technology brought in, these ground-penetrating radar systems that can actually see these unmarked shallow graves. And unfortunately, tragically, time and again in the last few months, we have seen unmarked graves often looks like their children, either in the grounds or, in this latest case this week, in a public cemetery next to what used to be one of these compulsory boarding schools. And you saw, you know, Canada Day is a big day of celebration. It marks the founding of the original colonies that came together to make Canada. You saw the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, having to tread a very fine line because it is like their July 4th. So he said, yes, we will try and celebrate. But it was then interesting, he said, but we will mostly reflect on the work that we all have to do. So you can see this is a very divisive thing for people who just want to celebrate Canada Day. But even the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, unable to really say, let's move on and forget this. It's clearly this tragedy they're going through again because of these discoveries of these graves.
Well, and the legacy of these boarding schools, it's not limited to Canada. Jennifer, we have our own history with that here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had these forced assimilation programs where you essentially, you know, coerced children, you know, mostly against their will and without parental consent to attend these schools where they were stripped of their language, their culture. You know, they were told that their, you know, often that their religion was pagan, forced to adopt, you know, kind of Catholic or Christian doctrines. And in fact, the Canadian residential school program was inspired directly by the American program. Canadian officials and politicians at the time actually sent a kind of an expeditionary, you know, force, you know, a group of politicians to go research what was going on in the U.S. and said, hey, that looks great. We should try that here. And so not only have we not really begun to address our horrific legacy here, but our legacy is directly related to what is happening in Canada, right? We, as a country, collectively bear a lot of the responsibility there too. And so, you know, we're seeing Deb Haaland, the first kind of Native American secretary to be, you know, Interior Secretary, starting to take up this this project, is saying we need to start looking at this in the U.S., but we are far, far behind where Canada is, and we're still seeing the reverberations in Canada. So they still have a long, long way to go in terms of actual policy, in terms of addressing the systemic legacy. You know, many, you know, Native First Nations peoples in Canada are still systematically discriminated against. So it's not over. This isn't an ancient history. This is very real, and it affects people's lives right now, today.
Catherine in Virginia had this comment: world leaders need to plan for economic refugees from climate change and massive population shifts that have already started. Well, on Sunday, the Biden administration announced that U.S. airstrikes had targeted facilities on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. The attack was linked to militias that have Iranian ties. U.S. officials said the strikes were reprisals for recent drone attacks targeting U.S. personnel in the region, and the violence didn't end there. Jen, this latest attack received only modest press attention here. Explain what's going on.
Yeah, so I think part of that has to do with the fact that this is kind of the set round we've seen from Biden. You know, this happened previously, the kind of similar strikes that were carried out. This is over, you know, it's part of kind of a long running sort of tit for tat, honestly, that has gone back, you know, many presidential administrations, with these Iranian-backed militia groups, Kataib, Hezbollah, and others, targeting U.S. forces at bases and other kind of military facilities inside Iraq. You know, they are against the U.S. kind of presence there and are making that opposition known through, you know, rocket strikes, through drone attacks, et cetera. And so these are these kind of retaliatory, although the administration calls them defensive. That's debatable, you know, depends on if it's really defensive, if it's not an active attack, but it's an ongoing series of attacks. So that's kind of a fight that's going on there. But they call them defensive, saying that they have the right to strike back against these groups and target them. They are very, you know, specifically targeting places that they say that they are using, that these groups are using to launch these attacks, places they use to smuggle arms, et cetera. So again, this is part of kind of an ongoing low intensity conflict that has been going on for a very long time between these militia groups that are backed by Iran and U.S. forces. And it's something that we continue to see pop up over and over again. And I think that partly explains why, you know, it's kind of like, oh, it's just another day, you know, another round of these strikes, even though they are very serious every time and they have very serious geopolitical consequences as well.
Well, let's take you back to the Oval Office and relevant remarks made by Joe Biden when he met with Israel's outgoing president. The president said he launched the strikes under the authority of Article 2 of the Constitution and then added this.
We're committed to unwavering commitment to your self-defense. Today, we're going to be discussing a broad range of challenges, including Iran. What I can say to you, Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, as they say.
Sean, Iran has now accelerated its uranium enrichment activities as a result of the U.S. pulling out of the nuclear agreement under President Trump. So is that a promise President Biden can really keep?
Well, it's hard to know that he can. I think the one of the clear things that has been illustrated this week again is that he's got these kind of cross currents on Iran policy, as David Sanger put it in the New York Times, that he has to deal with. And that is, one, how do you engage Iran and keep its nuclear program under check, while also dealing with your allies in Europe who want to do business with Iran and maintain that economic relationship, and then deal with this, this aggression on the ground against American troops and allies in Syria and Iraq. And I mean, it's just a reminder of how complex the Middle East is and the U.S. relationship with the region is, and how every president fairly early in their administration has to confront that and has to try and find their own way there. At the very least, you know, I think what we're going to see is Joe Biden continue to talk tough. He's going to try and thread this needle to get Iran back to the negotiating table. But it's hard at this point, given what we've seen over the last few administrations, to think that this is a problem that's going to go away under Joe Biden's watch.
Well, David, we know Iran's new, more conservative president, Ibrahim Raisi, replaces President Hassan Rouhani in August. That will likely make negotiations harder. So what incentive does the State Department have to make this relationship a priority?
So if you imagine the in-tray when it comes to Iran for either President Biden or his team at the State Department, as you say, item one is the fact that one hardliner has been replaced with an extremely hardliner, Ibrahim Raisi, who's so hardline he's actually subject to American sanctions for his role in ordering the extrajudicial execution of a huge number of political prisoners 30 years ago. So he's someone who's not even allowed to set foot in the United States for his record. So you've got that. He's going to make it more difficult. He's already said the day after he was elected that he is not going to actually renegotiate anything beyond the nuclear deal. Here's the problem, is that at the very time that Obama forged the nuclear pact, the criticism that was made of it was that it only looked at Iran's nuclear program, which is already a nightmarishly difficult problem, didn't tackle the fact that Iran funds militias around the Middle East, didn't tackle Iran's missile programs or its support for outright terrorism in some places. And now, with these F-16, F-15 strikes, that looks at the rest of the problem, because these weapons that they were going after were these very high precision drones, which have been launching these nighttime strikes just coming out of the sky and landing on special forces bases on the border between Iraq and Syria, so far not killing Americans, which points to the difficulty that Iran's sort of non-nuclear ability to make trouble still remains very, very serious problem. And the fundamental problem that Biden is wrestling with is he needs to get this Iran deal back up and running, he believes. Does that give him more leverage to go after the rest of Iran's bad behavior, or less leverage? Does he have to actually buy off the Iranians to deal with the nuclear stuff and not actually get anywhere with the things that are causing, like the strike we saw on Sunday night? And so, you know, his intray is a series of nightmarishly difficult problems, all of which really feed into each other.
Jen, I can see you nodding, and with all the complexity Sean and David laid out, are we getting a clear sense of the Biden administration's approach here?
Yes and no. You know, they very much, as David said, want to essentially get this entree into the outtray, right? They would very much like to move on. The Biden administration has a lot of other issues they would like to focus on, including COVID here and abroad, massive infrastructure plan they're trying to get through Congress, et cetera. And Iran is just kind of one of those pesky problems that keeps popping up. And, you know, to understand, too, the Iranian side of what's going on here, right, these strikes on, you know, by these Iranian-backed militias, they're not accidental, right? Iran very often will use these and kind of encourage these attacks when they want to send a message, sometimes when negotiations aren't going particularly well, as a kind of reminder, hey, we're still here, we can still get at you, basically anywhere you are, just a reminder, don't mess with us, right? And so, you know, while it does, the same way, you know, raise the problem of, yes, this malign activity, as we like to call it, this funding of these groups, that's exactly what Iran is trying to remind the U.S. of. We can get at you. So, you know, you need to make a deal with us. You need to work with us, because Iran is desperate to get out from underneath these economic sanctions. And, you know, Biden is fairly desperate to have to be able to move on from Iran. So I do think there is still some hope potentially for a deal. The problem is whether it's going to be, as David said, you know, a deal that actually takes into account broader things like their missile programs, et cetera, which seems very unlikely. That's why the Obama administration didn't do it in the first place, because it's really difficult. They, you know, Iran has said that stuff is completely off the table, or whether it's just going to be a kind of, you know, low bar back to the, you know, the status quo ante of the Iran deal, and then we can all kind of move on and pretend that none of this happened.
Well, we try and avoid acronyms if possible, but this week, and in a bipartisan move, the House voted to repeal two decades-old authorizations of the use of military force in the Middle East, or AUMF. Virginia Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger explained why this vote was so important.
It is important that every time we send service members off to war, we here in the United States Congress are taking the step of being responsible by voting on authorizations. And today it's time to vote to take this outdated resolution off the books.
Sean, give us some context here and explain what it might mean the next time this White House wants to use military force.
Well, look, this is part of a debate and a tussle over war powers that has gone back and forth between the executive branch and the legislative branch in this country for decades. Authorization that President Biden, President Trump before him, President Obama have used to carry out actions in places like Syria and Iraq have depended on this authorization to use military force that dates back to 2002 and the Iraq War. And there are a lot of people in Congress who rightly are saying we need to have a better debate in Congress about how we use American military forces abroad, how we use American power abroad. That shouldn't just be the right or the responsibility of the president and the executive branch. We heard Senator Chris Murphy this week. He's a big ally of Joe Biden, say he was looking at what was happening with these Iran strikes and seeing a low-intensity war develop, and therefore there ought to be a debate in Congress and a real establishment of the parameters for any action by the U.S. military related to Iran and what's happening in Syria and Iraq. Now, the story of this debate has been that it's been going on for decades and that it's never resolved itself, because the executive will always insist on its power. as President Biden did this week under Article 2 of the Constitution, to control American military action abroad. And the Congress will always insist that it has a responsibility to keep that power in check. Any tangible changes from this? I don't think we're going to see any, but it's certainly a debate that America needs to be having.
I want to briefly touch on one other headline this week relevant to U.S. relations in the Middle East. That was the news that former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld died. He was 88.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
David, just explain the role Donald Rumsfeld played in the U.S.'s role in Iraq.
Well, he was not only one of the leading champions of going after Iraq and toppling the regime of Saddam Hussein, even though there were people inside the administration and outside who said this isn't fundamentally an Iraqi problem. This was after the 9/11 strikes that was caused by al-Qaeda, who had been hiding in Afghanistan, not in Iraq. And so you remember, this is, we'll remember all of the kind of controversial evidence that then later turned out to not be true about weapons of mass destruction and a potential link with al-Qaeda. But what's striking about Donald Rumsfeld is it's a reminder that before the rest of the world was very, very angry and upset with people like Donald Trump for saying America first and being sort of selfish and saying they didn't care about the rest of the world, America used to be unpopular in the rest of the world for being extremely hawkish and being willing to use American military force all around the world to topple regimes, but in a way that seemed kind of to many non-Americans, some in America, as particularly kind of callous and brutal. And so I think Donald Rumsfeld is a reminder that before Trump and America first, you had extremely hawkish figures like Donald Rumsfeld and his colleague Dick Cheney, who were willing to use American force in ways that looked as though they didn't care about other countries' sovereignty and were pretty callous about the consequences when American force had huge unforeseen consequences in a place like Iraq.
Well, one more quick note. After nearly 20 years, the U.S. military has now left the Bagram airfield in Afghanistan. It was the epicenter of its war to oust the Taliban and hunt down those behind the 9/11 terrorist attacks. NPR says the airfield has been handed over to the Afghan National Security and Defense Force in its entirety. Now let's turn to COVID. Cases are rapidly rising in multiple countries across Africa. The World Health Organization says cases are doubling every 3 weeks.
We expect things to only get worse. Less than 1% of Africa's population has been vaccinated. Vaccines donated next year will be far too late for those who are dying today, or being infected today, or at risk today.
That was Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the WHO, speaking on June 18th. Jen, which countries have been hardest hit?
Well, we're seeing a lot of this in Southern Africa, in particular in Sub-Saharan Africa. We're seeing South Africa in particular being really hard hit. They have also had some serious issues with vaccination problems. They've had to return vaccines. We're also seeing Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Zambia, Namibia. It's pretty bad and it's pretty widespread. And the problem is, you know, as the WHO has said, you know, just a little more than 1% of the entire African population has been fully vaccinated. And so what we're seeing is the combination of really low vaccination rates. And this is not because of vaccine hesitancy necessarily, like we're seeing in you know, more wealthy developed countries. This is just purely a lack of access, the lack of actual physical vaccines to be able to get into people's arms. And so, you know, we're seeing that combined with this much more, you know, virulent spreading Delta variant of COVID that spreads just much more rapidly. There's some evidence, so it's not quite clear whether it's deadlier, but it definitely spreads a lot faster than, you know, the original kind of COVID strain. And so we're seeing that kind of awful combination really hitting places, not just Africa, but it's really, really bad because the vaccination rates are just so low there. And, you know, we talk a lot about, especially here in the U.S., about trying to overcome that vaccine hesitancy. And in many parts of the world, people are looking at and saying, we'd love to have the luxury of getting to casually say, no, we don't want that vaccine. You know, there are lines when vaccines do become available, just, you know, wrapping around blocks for people who are desperate to get the vaccine. And, you know, this is, again, now a preventable disease. And unfortunately, it's only the case for some countries that it's preventable. In many other places, including in Africa, it is just something that is still ongoing and it's getting worse. So while the rest of the world, you know, especially here in the US, we're all kind of moving on and happy to be able to take off the masks and go back to movie theaters, people are still dying by the thousands because this is not over.
And Sean, very briefly, there were or have been efforts in the international community to try to get vaccines to countries that needed them. Where do those efforts stand?
Well, we saw the G7, the group of seven the richest nations in the world, pledge to throw out billions of doses of vaccines to the world in the coming years. We've seen the Biden administration, the European Union, and others pledge to send vaccines overseas. And yet the common criticism you hear from health experts over and over again is that all of those efforts are just too slow. I mean, if you look at South Africa today, it is, you know, they have enough doses for, they've administered 3 million doses. That is roughly 3% of the population of almost 60 million people. It's so far to go. Countries like Nigeria, we're seeing, you know, the vaccine coverage there just be incredibly low. And the real risk is that we're just going to see a huge increase in the months to come in both cases and deaths, unfortunately.
Well, let's continue with how well or how badly the world is dealing with the pandemic. And Jen, I just wanted to hear from you briefly on this issue of vaccine distribution. It's one thing to have the vaccines in hand. It's another to distribute them. But also the strain COVID places on the health infrastructure of developing nations that may not have a lot of health infrastructure to begin with.
Right. So what's really fascinating about the Africa case is that early on when the vaccines first came online, there was a lot of talk, including by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, the Global Vaccine Alliance, that Africa could actually be very extremely well placed because of their long history of, you know, launching massive vaccination campaigns for, you know, and dealing with huge disease outbreaks from, you know, Ebola to polio, you know, et cetera, yellow fever. And so there was actually a lot of hope that it could go really well and that that Africa was even potentially better placed than many other parts of the world. The problem is, you know, they're huge. There are many problems. One of the big problems we're seeing is that the types of vaccines that we have here have to be stored in very specific, you know, conditions, very specific, you know, low temperatures, have to be taken care of, et cetera, very, you know, with specific infrastructure. And that stuff may not necessarily already be in place. And there's also the fact that many of these batches of vaccines, several countries, including South Sudan, have complained that they're getting them at almost the last minute, right before they're about to expire. And so they're saying, yeah, you're giving them to us, but they expire in 2 weeks. How are we supposed to distribute these? No country could do that, right? That's just astronomically difficult to do across the, you know, large areas, rural areas, even in big cities. And so I think some of the complaints about infrastructure or the excuses of infrastructure are being used to kind of paper over the fact that a lot of these countries are getting these vaccines in you know, not in the best conditions. They are not being provided, you know, in a timely fashion. And so they are struggling. And so, yes, it's technically kind of infrastructure mm-hmm. that they're not getting these out, but it's also the fact that they're getting them at the last minute. Of course, there are, you know, basic issues, you know, poor roads, very rural areas, et cetera. But again, Africa has a lot of experience dealing with this. So I think it's a bit of a sort of a kind of bait and switch to blame it completely on Africa's lack of infrastructure, because they have very good health infrastructure when it comes to mass vaccination campaigns.
And when we look more broadly globally, and we look at the strain COVID is putting on healthcare infrastructure, I mean, we've seen what it looked like here in the U.S. What is it looking like in other places?
Absolutely. You know, even just the lack of oxygen supplies that we're seeing, you know, we saw that in India. We're now seeing that in South Africa. There are cascading effects, right? And so it's not just the virus. It's dealing with, you know, the effects of the virus. And then you have all the healthcare workers who in some places may not also be vaccinated. So they're getting, you know, knocked out with the virus and having to stay home in quarantine. You're seeing also just on top of that, all of the kind of other medical procedures that have gotten put on the back burner while people are dealing with COVID because they can't deal with other things, those are all piling up as the months and months go on. So you're going to continue to see these kind of cascading impacts on the health infrastructure. And until we get serious vaccination levels happening, it's going to continue that way.
Well, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said this week his country faced, quote, a great crisis. State media reported that Kim criticized his own top officials for a crucial lapse, although no details were given. Now, David, this is a rare admission by Kim into what may be going on in that country. What more do we know and what does it signal for you?
So as ever with North Korea, which is one of the world's most secretive and closed countries, yes, it was an admission in as much as we know that one of the members of the top five-member presidium was sacked, and he talked, as you say, about a grave mistake. There was incompetence and irresponsibility. But just to underline how secretive this country is being about COVID, until now, in fact, still, North Korea says it has never had a single case, which nobody believes. And so, you know, they're saying that they've got a problem there, but and they've kept the borders closed, basically almost completely closed since January 2020, to the point that although they're having a major hunger crisis at the moment because of some bad harvests and general breakdown of their economy, they are refusing food aid from places like South Korea, which are repeatedly offering to send food aid in because they're clearly so worried that the extremely weak health system in North Korea cannot cope with any COVID at all, that they seem to be taking the gamble, as far as we can tell, that they just have to keep the place locked down completely from the outside world. Where I am here in China, China is pretty much their only really big friend in the world, and there's a reasonable amount of trade across the China-North Korea border in normal times. I've been there myself and seen the trucks going back and forth. That has been completely halted since January 2020. So we don't know what's happening. Most foreign diplomats, almost all foreign diplomats, have had to leave because conditions are so strict there at the moment. So that already terribly unhappy, miserable, locked down Stalinist hermit kingdom, there could be a major COVID outbreak going on in there, and we simply don't know.
Well, another country struggling right now with COVID is Australia. Seven cities are now in lockdown. That's about half the population. Sean, some are blaming the government's contradictory messaging on vaccines. Lay out what's going on there for us.
Yeah, look, this is a bit personal for me because I'm Australian and my mother is caught in one of these lockdowns just north of Sydney right now. But really, I mean, the story we're seeing in Australia is one that we've seen in a lot of places, which is a government that thought it had a great handle on this pandemic, that Australia has managed through a series of strict lockdowns over the last 18 months to keep COVID in check. Just to give you some perspective, fewer people have died in Australia, less than 1,000, than have died in the county in Maryland that I'm sitting in right now. So, I mean, Australia, when we talk about a surge in cases there, we are still talking about a few hundred cases in the most populous state, New South Wales. But the real issue here is this flip that a lot of governments have failed to make from effectively containing the virus to vaccinating populations. And in Australia now, less than 15% of the population is vaccinated. And they also have a governmental decision that is coming back to haunt them, and that is that they bet heavily on the AstraZeneca vaccine early on. We know that that had some issues with blood clotting that were raised in Europe and elsewhere. As a result of that, the Australian government decided that it would limit the distribution of AstraZeneca to people who were over 60 and actually recommend that people under 60 choose other vaccines. Well, they don't have the supply of those other vaccines there. This latest outbreak is literally a result of a lack of vaccination. In New South Wales, one of the outbreaks that was tracked, they did the they tracked the outbreak to a air crew member who was visiting from overseas and to the driver of the car that was ferrying him and some other colleagues to their hotel. And that driver had not been vaccinated. And as a result, you had an outgrowth of the thing there. Unfortunately, in Australia, this is also leading to a bigger national conversation. It's leading to the type of xenophobia that we were seeing in the U.S. at a certain point. Today, the government announced a new plan. As part of that, they're halving the amount of people they allow in from overseas each week to just 3,000 a week. That means that, you know, the borders are going to remain closed for a long time. And we're hearing a big national discussion, or at least I'm reading it from afar, a big national discussion about whether or not Australia's reverting starting to some of its historic inward-lookingness, some of the fear that led to what people have dubbed Fortress Australia in the past. This is a country that has not had a great record in terms of its treatment of immigration, of immigrants and refugees and non-Anglo populations over the decades. Look, you know, this is a reminder also that as we sit here in the United States and life gets back to normal, we're a long way from life getting back to normal in some other rich countries in the world. You know, my mother, just to bring it back to the personal level, does now not expect to be able to come visit us here in the United States until sometime deep in 2022, more than a year from now, we expect. Now, the government has said that it will not allow Australians to travel overseas until next year. And that is, you know, that's a blow personally, but it's also a reflection of just how far we are from getting back to normal for a lot of people.
Well, and Jen, I just wonder what health officials are saying about the likelihood that we talk about the end of the pandemic, but really what we're going to look at is COVID being endemic. And when we look at the patchwork approach to it here in the United States, and then when you zoom out globally, it's the same thing. And of course, it's all tied into access and those other conversations we've had on the show before. But what are health officials saying about that?
Right. Well, absolutely. And I think the bigger question, too, here is that, you know, the very, you know, serious reality, which is that the more this virus is allowed to be out in the wild and spreading rapidly, the more chances it has to evolve and develop even more, you know, dangerous and potentially more deadly strains and variants. You know, we've already seen, we've gone all the way to the Delta. There's now a Delta Plus variant circulating, which extra bad. So, you know, the health officials from the beginning have been saying that, you know, this isn't over until it's really over, until we have a grip on it, you know, in every country. And yes, it may not be zero, you know, absolute cases that it's eradicated, but this unchecked spread that we're seeing is where it really allows the virus to mutate and evolve in a way that potentially, you know, we've been really lucky so far that the vaccines that we have are still really effective against the Delta variant. But we may not always be that lucky, which means that it could actually end up coming back in the U.S. and, you know, overcoming the vaccines that we have. So again, you know, just the fact that we're getting back to normal in some places, it doesn't mean that this is over. This is going to continue to spread until every country is able to get a really serious handle on it. And the way to do that is vaccination.
Well, let's head to China, which is throwing a huge party as its ruling Communist Party turns 100. David, you were in Tiananmen Square for some of the celebrations this week. What was that like?
It was really striking. So Tiananmen Square is their kind of big ceremonial capital for national events, but this was a party event. This is a reminder that the Communist Party doesn't just control, you know, this and that branch of government, it controls everything. And so we saw a military flypast, we saw some soldiers marching around, because in China, the People's Liberation Army is the army of the Communist Party. It answers to the Communist Party, not to the state. And we saw Xi Jinping, who we call president normally, his much more important job is he's general secretary of the Communist Party. And what was fascinating about being in the square on Thursday morning was that this was a Communist Party event. And you saw party members everywhere singing Communist Party songs, being addressed by Xi Jinping. And it felt weirdly, although it was extremely strictly controlled and there was lots of kind of military hardware around, it felt like a kind of party, a sort of family event, talking to itself about their 100 years since they were founded. The other thing that was really striking was how aggressive Xi Jinping's language was towards the rest of the world, because what has changed about the Communist Party is their willingness to say that not only are they the best form of government for China, but that they are superior to Western democracies like America. And we're seeing this drumbeat of propaganda at the moment that look at things like the death rates that you've seen in America in COVID. Look at the way that partisan paralysis is stopping Congress from getting big things done. How lucky the Chinese are to be run by one party which has the best interests of all Chinese people at heart and isn't a kind of partisan squabbling democracy like America. That very frontal challenge to democracy, as they would say, an inferior system, has been the kind of motif of these celebrations.
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping warned foreign forces who attempt to bully China will, quote, get their heads bashed. Here's part of the speech he gave on Thursday.
The Chinese people are people who uphold justice and are not afraid of violence. The Chinese people have never bullied, oppressed, or enslaved the people of other countries. They haven't in the past, they are not now, and they won't be in the future. At the same time, the Chinese people will never allow any foreign forces to bully, oppress, or enslave us. Anyone who dares try to do that will have their heads bashed bloodied against the Great Wall of Steel, forged by over 1.4 billion Chinese people.
David, how did the crowd respond to that message?
That was the biggest applause line of the entire speech. That was a kind of real roar. Now, we're now seeing this kind of really interesting debate here because a lot of Chinese people, including people who are not kind of fanatical defenders of the government, they say, actually, that phrase about bashing your head bloody against a wall is a kind of set phrase here. It just means, you know, being very frustrated. It's not a literal thing. But here's the point. They know what they're doing. They knew that that line was going to sound extremely aggressive to the rest of the world. And I think what that tells you is that the Communist Party, now that it doesn't really deliver Marxist-Leninism, certainly doesn't deliver communism, it's basically using nationalism as the driving force to rally support behind one-party rule and threatening the outside world, talking about how the outside world is a bully, that America is a kind of bully in decline, is the key for them to maintaining support. And they have a lot of support. I mean, what was frightening was I was sitting there and people were really, really into that line.
Sean, very briefly, can you remind us of the current status of U.S.-China relations and whether there are any efforts to de-escalate the trade war between the two countries?
Yeah, well, look, this week was a reminder that there is a singular foreign policy challenge for Joe Biden as he gets his presidency underway, and that is how to deal with a rising China and the competition with China, both in terms of the economic competition, but also the security competition. I mean, for those of us who grew up during the Cold War, we saw that imagery coming out of Beijing and Tiananmen Square this week, and it really harkened back to that. And there's a lot of fears here in Washington that we are in a new Cold War with the United States, and the consequences of that are going to be there for everyone. Just a note on the economic relationship, we have new trade data out from the U.S. Census this morning, and the U.S. exported more to China this May than it has in any May previously. So there's still a strong economic relationship there.
That's Sean Donnan, senior writer for Bloomberg. Also with us, David Rennie, the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and Jen Williams, senior foreign editor of Vox. She's also the co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Thanks, everybody. 1A's senior producer is Jonquilin Hill. Paige Osborne is our managing producer, and Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, distributed by NPR. This is 1A.